All right, okay. We have been exploring over the last couple of weeks the manner in which the values that we've inherited as a community, namely the values of Chazal, are reflected in the broader society, broader Jewish society of the first couple of centuries of the Common Era that we've been examining. We've looked at archaeological evidence, we've looked at the imagery that can be found in synagogues. We've noted that pagan imagery seems to have pervaded a lot of the scene that we can glimpse in the domains inhabited by common Jews in these couple of centuries. And we've primarily, over the last couple of weeks, sought to explain how this imagery could have been integrated into a rabbinic worldview. Now, the reason that we've been asking these questions, or really the assumption upon which these questions have been premised, is the idea that rabbis were a part of the society that we're examining. Now, what I mean by that is not simply that they existed at the same time as the society that we've been examining. What I mean is that they were a character actor, if you will, in the life of the society that we've been examining.
Catholic priests who really weren't living as equals with the rest of the population.
Right. Well, right. In that sense, in other words, that's a good point. Mr. Comment raises the idea of the degree of marginality that we imagine for rabbis. What were they a part of society? Were they on the fringes of society? Were they irrelevant, or were they in control of a society? Were they exerting authority over society? So I guess the questions that we have to ask ourselves would be, number one, do rabbis have a role to play in the society that we're discussing? And if so, what is it? And second of all, what are our preconceived notions about what that role should be, what that role was, and is there a way that we can confirm or disconfirm our preconceived notions? So I think that the conventional wisdom that we've all been brought up with in one form or another is that the rabbis, once upon a time, in sort of a golden age, if you will, of Chazal, were in control of society. They ran society in a legal sense through the Sanhedrin. They dictated the social norms of the society and maybe some of the public ritual components of the society through the office of the Nasi, of the patriarch. And the rabbinic presence in all the cities, whether through control of the synagogue or in Batei Midrash, effectively meant that rabbis were at every level of society present. Now, we've had occasion to question many of those assumptions. We've seen synagogues that seemed more rabbinic than others. We've seen some synagogues that have seemed less rabbinic than others, whatever that term may mean. But We've certainly seen that rabbis have some role to play. We examined the synagogue floor a couple of weeks ago from Tzipori, from Sepphoris in the Galil, that has artwork on it that reflects interpretations of the Bible that are attributed to the sages, that are attributed to Chazal. So we know that there is some degree of imprint that the rabbis leave on Jewish society in Eretz Yisrael during this time period. But we haven't really head-on confronted the question, where are rabbis in society, and can we identify them in the remains of the society that we're discussing? So what I actually would like to get to this week is really just to tackle that question head on. Are there rabbis that we can find in late antiquity other than in the writings of Chazal? So take a look at source number one. Source number one is going to really just get us right to the heart of the question. And the question that we're really going to have to ask ourselves is as follows. What does it mean to be a rabbi? And you'll see why I'm asking that question in a moment. So what I've given you here are two inscriptions from the floor, smack in the middle of a big shul that was found that dates to the 5th century of the Common Era, from Chamat Gader in the north. Now, the inscription, the round one that I've given you to the left, is at the very top of the shul, right in front of where the Aron would have been. And the rectangular inscription right below that is in the floor panel below that. So, and then in the text that I've given you is sort of a text of what these inscriptions say. But we'll run through them. Now, bear in mind, as we're reading this inscription, keep in mind the titles that, that each person who's named in these inscriptions has. And then, bear in mind also why the person may be named in this inscription, what it means to be named in this inscription. And then we're going to have to ask ourselves, what does all of this mean? In particular, what do the titles that we encounter here mean? Now, the inscription reads as follows, starting with the top one. The top of the text that I've given you, this bit over here corresponds to the text in the circle. It says as follows: Tchir latav, kuris haplis, v'kura protone, v'kura celestis chatana, v'komes peroros bara, v'koris potias chatana, v'koris chanina bara, heinon v'nehon de mitzvason tediran, b'chol asar, rather de mitzvason tediran b'chol asar. Dehavon hacha chamisha dinar and dehav melech alma yitain berchasa be'amalhon amen amen sela. So the first half of the inscription reads as follows, the part that's in that little circle. And be remembered for good, kuros haples and kura protone. Kuros and kura respectively are male and female. It sort of means
Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah, like Mr. and Mrs. But it's like a nice way of saying, in other words, it's like saying trying to think what your honor, so on, your honor and her honor, ploni almoni. So kuras haples and kura protone and kuras celestius, his son-in-law, and comes foraras. Comes comes from a Latin word, also meaning sort of like Mister, but sir, right? Sir is a good example, right? Sir is a good way of phrasing it. Comes foraras, his son, and kurafotios, his son-in-law. And Kuros Chanina, his son. So this whole family, coming from Kuros Haples, who was the sort of the patriarch of the family, they and their children, whose charitable deeds are found everywhere, the mitzvos on tediron b'chol asar, their mitzvos, here I think mitzvos means their deeds of charity, and you'll see why in a second, and who have given five dinars of gold. May the king of the world place his blessing on their property, amen, amen, selah. Okay. Who are the people who have been named here? Not, in other words, they're not famous. We don't know them from anywhere else other than here. But who are they, and why are they named here?
They're the Max Sterns of their generation.
Excellent. Right. That's exactly what they are. These are the Max Sterns, right? The Mendel Gottesmans, the Herman Gottesmans, the Max Grills. Right. These are the big donors of the synagogue. Right. These are the big hitters, the sugar daddies, the sugar mamas. Now, how much did they donate?
Five dinars
of gold.
What is a dinar?
So, what is a dinar? So, it's an excellent question. So, five dinars of gold. So, a third of a dinar of gold would have represented about a week's worth of work. A third of an average. An average person's full week's worth of work would have produced a third of a golden dinar. So if that's the case, so this is going to be about 15 weeks worth of work. So it's a fair amount. It's a fair amount. They just kind of took this and they donated it. Okay, so this whole family comes in for a big yashkoach in the beginning of the inscription. Now, moving down to that little rectangular part, So now we've just talked about sort of the platinum members of the shul. Now we're going to get to the next group. Ud chirlatav, and also remembered for good, Rav Tanchum Halevi Bar Chalfa, Dehav Chad Shemisin, Ud chirlatav Manaka Disosita Tziporaya, V'koris Patrick de Kvar Kavya, V'yosei Bar Dostai, Demin Kvar Nachum, Diyahavon Tlatehon, rather Tlos Garmin, rather Diyahavon Tlatehon Tlos Garmin, Melech Alma Yitain Berchasa Ba'amalhon Amen Amen Sela. Okay. Now, remembered for good should be Rav Tanchum, the Levite, the son of Chalfa, who has donated one Shemesis, that's a third of a gold dinar, and Kuros Patricius of Kfar, or Kuros Patrick of Kfar Akavia, and Yossi, son of Dositheus, that's Dostai. If you see Dostai in the Gemara, that's the Greek name Dositheus. Dosevius of Kfar Nachum. What is Kfar Nachum in the Gospels? Capernaum, right, excellent, Capernaum. Who have donated all three, in other words, each one of them has donated, three scruples, which is the equivalent of one silver dinar. May the king of the world place his blessing on their property. Amen, amen, sela. Okay. Excellent question. So Mrs. Deegan is already picking up on what may be a structuring principle in terms of who gets mentioned where. So we know the Max Stearns, right, the Kuros Hoplis, that family, they're mentioned first because they donate 15, they donate 5 gold dinar. Now, a chemisus, which is what Rav Tanchum Halevi donates, is 1/3 of a single gold dinar. So it's much less than the Max Stearns, but maybe that's the second most. So how much is a silver dinar, which of the people named afterwards, all three of them each donate a silver dinar? So the answer is that a garma, so each one of these people donates 3 garmin. So 3 garmin is a silver dinar, because 1 garma equals 1/3 of a silver dinar. Now, 1 garma also equals 1/4 of a gold dinar. So let's do the back of the napkin math, right? If 1 garma equals 1/3 of a dinar and 1/4 of a gold dinar, right? 1/3 of a silver dinar, 1/4 of a gold dinar. So if you donate 3 garmin, so how much have you donated in gold dinar, in gold dinarii? 3/4, right?
Is that relevant to the question of who's a rabbi?
Well, so we're going to get to that in a second. But what's important to note is that if each one of these three guys individually donated 3/4 of a gold dinar, so what is strange about this list?
Why are they after the other guy?
Why are they after the other guy, right? Rav Tanchum Halevi Bar Chalfa donated much less than them, and yet he's mentioned first for whatever reason.
He's a haram.
Ah, so maybe, so Mrs. Deegan is leading us in the right direction. Maybe the reason he is mentioned here is because he is a Rav, right? He's a rabbi. Maybe that's why he gets on this list, right? Now, this actually leads us right into the question, which is this. Rav here ostensibly should be translated as rabbi. Now, is there any reason...
No, I think your math is wrong.
No?
Because I think when you said a silver dinar is a quarter of a third, of 1/3 of the gold...
It's three-fourths. 3/4, right? 1 silver dinar is 3/4 of a gold dinar.
So the silver is more valuable than the gold, is what you're saying?
No. In other words, the
1 silver dinar is equivalent to 3/4 of a gold dinar.
Right. So in other words,
dinar would be $1, and the silver dinar would be 75 cents.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. Because silver is much cheaper than gold.
You see what I'm saying?
Right. Right. Well, the gold. Right. So
the three of them gave.
Yeah. So. That would be, yeah.
So it's not that, you know, the rabbi may have given more than the other.
Right.
Three of them together, three silver dinars could equal right. 3/4 of a gold dinar.
So the reason that,
giving a quarter.
Good question. So the reason, right. No, so the reason the exchange rate works out that way is because although we call a gold dinar, so most of what was in a gold dinar might not have been gold. The reason we call a silver dinar is, even though most of what was in it may not have been silver, the reason. Yeah, very much so. In other words, very much so.
No, I'm saying did they make one thing of bronze and one of gold?
Right. So in other words, if it was pure gold and pure silver, then the exchange rate would obviously be much different. But the way that coins work is that some of them are much higher quality than others. So you could have, for instance, a sella entire, and you could have something called a sella. So you could have something called, let's say, a silver sella entire. You could have a silver sella. In southern Israel, and they would be worth, and even though it sounds like they should be worth exactly the same thing, the one from Tyre would be worth much more because it was much higher quality metal. So that's usually why these things work out the way they do. But that is a really good question. It needs to be clarified, right? So on the other hand, what Dr. Schwartzman, I think, is pointing out here, which is well worth considering, is that it doesn't necessarily need to be that the first guy is mentioned first, even though he gave less, is because he's a rabbi. It could be, well, look, the other guys gave technically more, but they gave silver. This guy gave gold. Gold is better than silver, So we're, this is ordered from the highest type of metal to the lowest type of metal. And I think that's actually a fair point, which leads us to ask, which leads us to have to ask the question, can we say for certain that the person who is mentioned in this inscription as a rav is a rabbi in the sense of chazal?
No.
So not necessarily. So what's another indicator that maybe, in other words, I don't think we can say for certain that he wasn't, but what's another indicator that perhaps he might not have been?
He's giving that
right, true. Also, another fair point. But notice, what are the other titles that come up in this inscription?
Levite, son.
Right, so in other words, there's one of the people here also, Rev Tanchum, is a Levite. What are the other people called?
Well, you have Kuros.
Kuros.
And
Komes.
Yeah, Kfar.
So Kfar is just a village. Kfar Nachum, the village of Nachum, the Capernaum. But Mr. Comet is correct that we have titles like Kuros, titles like Komes, right? These are titles that, as Mrs. Falk pointed out, really just mean sir. It's a nice way of saying sir. We shouldn't assume that someone in this inscription who is given the title Kuros would have been any different than someone who was given the title Komes. There's no reason to assume that those were different.
We have in Chazal a reference to a Rav Tanchum.
That's another good question that Mr. Kamen is asking. Is let's say we could find someone whose name in Chazal was Rav Tanchum Halevi. So would we be warranted in saying that this is the same person? We're going to see later an inscription of on a grave of a person named Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Now we know there's a Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, a famous Amora Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi of the first generation of Eretz Yisrael. So would we be warranted in saying that just because the two names appear, that we should assume they're the same person? So I think the answer is no. These names are both very common names. Tanchum is a very common name. There are lots of Levites in Israel. We would need to know more about the person in order to, I think, make the identification. We'd need to know perhaps who the parents are, perhaps who the children are, and then see that it matches up with what we find in Chazal. But we're going to get to all of that in a couple of minutes. For now, I'd just like to point out that it's possible, not necessary, but possible, that Rav here, the term Rav, is the equivalent of Kuros, or Komes, which is to say, not rabbi in the sense of someone who is ordained, but sir. We use this phrase all the time. If you don't want to call up someone for an aliyah as harav, but you want to give them a little extra kavod, call them Reb, right? Reb Tzviari ben Shalmaneo, that's how I would get called up, right? You call them Reb, because Reb is bekavodik without going overboard with harav, or moreno harav, or something like that. So Rav here could just mean wealthy donor. So that's the question we have to ask ourselves. When we encounter rabbis in the archaeological record, we're going to see that we encounter them quite frequently. If we have reason to identify one or another of them as someone who was definitely mentioned in Chazal, that's one thing. For the most part, with one exception, which we'll get to hopefully next week or the week after, with one exception, the answer is we don't have anybody like that. So if you have all these rabbis that appear in the archaeological record, should we assume that they are members of Chazal, and therefore all the contexts in which they appear and appear to be honored, we should say, well, those are communities that were clearly maybe not controlled by, but at least influenced by or in contact with rabbis, and therefore we would have a jumping off point to say that rabbis do play some sort of role in the society, and then we'd have to figure out what that role is. Or should we say no? The rabbis mentioned in the archaeological context in which we find them aren't rabbis at all. The rabbis, capital R, are to be found in Chazal, but that's mostly a literary fiction. When we find these rabbis in the inscription, rabbi just means sir, wealthy donor. So that's the question we're going to have to ask ourselves. Yes?
Maybe they're talking about someone who
learned it. Right. Oh, excellent point. So keep that thought. Avi just said, what is, in other words, rabbi could mean someone who's learned. So that really is, what I think what Avi's really asking is, what does the term rabbi imply? What are all of the connotations of the title rabbi? And maybe there's an evolution in that process. In other words, we have to go, what we have to do if we want to answer Avi's question correctly and thoroughly and rigorously, we're going to have to go all the way back to the earliest occurrences of the term that we can find and then trace its development. And that gets us to source number two. Yes?
The other point is that when they, in the literature, it's always rabbi. Is it Rav?
Ah, excellent question. So what do we have here?
And also, the rabbis never came about. I mean, the term rabbi didn't come around until about the second century anyway.
Right, so we're going to have to figure... Right, so we're going to have to figure out... We're going to have to figure out the time bound here. But Dr. Schwarzhorn is asking an important question. The title Rav might not tell us anything, but maybe another type of title might. In other words, we know there's a whole range of titles that we essentially put under the rubric of rabbi that appear in Chazal, but not all of them are Rav. Another Rav, Rabbi, right? In other words, they're Hanasi, right? In other words, they're Rabban. They're also like Rabban Gamliel, right? There are all sorts of titles that we find in Chazal. Are any of them distinctive that maybe we find only in Chazal and nowhere else? And do any of those titles appear in the archaeological record? That might be one way to shortcut our way to solving this problem. In other words, if we could find a title that for which we have no evidence other than in rabbinic literature, and that in rabbinic literature clearly signifies great rabbinic learning, and then we find that title in the archaeological record, we have no other explanation for it, so perhaps we should say that this is a rabbi. So that's one of the things we're going to have to ask ourselves. Can we find anything in the archaeological record that is dispositive, one way or another? And if it is, what does that tell us about this society?
What about the archaeological records between the first and the second temple?
Between first and second temple. So I'm actually going to take you... you know what? That actually is an excellent question which gets us, much like Avi's question, to the very first source of source number two. Take a look at source number two. Source number two is from precisely that period. Or a little bit before. It's from the eve... it's from the eve of the destruction of the first temple. This is from... a verse in Jeremiah, in Yirmiyahu, and it tells us the following. In describing the process, over a long course of describing the process by which the first temple is destroyed and the kingdom of Judah is conquered in the 6th century before the Common Era, we're told, inter alia, Vayishlach Nebuzaradan Rav Tabachim, Unavushazban Rav Saris, V'nergal Shar'etze Rav Mag, V'chol Rabbi Melech Bavel. Pasuk says, Nebuzaradan, the Rav Tabachim, and then Nebushazban, the Rav Saris, and then Nergal Sharetzer, the Rav Mag, and all of the Ravs of the king of Bavel sent. Now, what is the term Rav? I've left the term Rav untranslated here. What does Rav mean in the context? If I say that Nebuzaradan was one of the chief generals of Nebuchadnezzar, who helped him conquer the First Temple Society. So when I say that he's Rav Tabachim, what does that mean? He's the rabbi, he's Nebuchadnezzar's rabbi?
No, they're called the headmen.
The headmen.
The chief.
Right? Yeah, the head honcho. Right, Rav here, Rav Tabachim, and this is exactly how the title Rav is used in Akkadian literature, in Ugaritic literature throughout the ancient Near East. Rav here means what? Chief or captain, right? So he's the captain of the guard, something like that. Rav Saris would be there for the captain of the eunuchs, which would be another official. Rav Mag, right? So based on what we know about Akkadian, Rav Mag would be the chief soothsayer. And then all of the rabbis of the king of Babel, that would mean not all of his rabbinic scholars, and not the kolel of Nebuchadnezzar, right? It would be all of his chiefs, right? All of his captains, so all of his officers. So Rav, in its earliest incarnation, doesn't indicate learning, it doesn't indicate teaching, it indicates mastery, or chieftainship, or position. Okay. It might not, right? In other words, it's just something floating around.
Is there any reference to Rav before Yirmiyahu, or is that the first time?
I'll give you another example. If anyone remembers when Yerushalayim is besieged by the Assyrians in the 8th century before the Common Era, the general of the Assyrians, so the emperor is Sennacherib, but his general, who sort of gives a big speech to try and demoralize the defenders of Yerushalayim, does anyone recall his name? Rav Shakeh. Right, Rav Shakeh, so it's taken by the old translators to be a proper name, a proper noun. Rav Shakeh was his name, like Harry or Tom, right? Rav Shakeh, though, is probably a title. He was the Rav Shakeh, whatever Shakeh means, but he was the chieftain. There are lots of other examples we could go through in Tanakh where the term Rav is used to mean a chieftain, but it seems to be the equivalent of... well, let's think about it. There's another person who is the chief of the Tabachim in Chumash. Sar HaTabachim, right? Potiphar is the Sar HaTabachim, right? So it seems to be the equivalent of Sar, something like that. Okay. Now, that's as far as the biblical period. When it comes to the next really prominent attestations of the word Rav, and here we're going to see that it's vocalized differently than Rav, is actually in the Gospels. Take a look at the Gospel of Mark. We've had occasion to mention several times earlier in this course the theory of Mark and priority, which is simply the theory that Mark is, which is the theory. It's more or less, we can confirm it. Mark is the earliest of the Gospels. So now, Mark has a story which is in the other Gospels as well, which talks about Osa Aish leading his disciples through a course of what seemed to be prophetic pronouncements on his part and miraculous doings on his part, and then his students sort of comment on what's going on, and then he explains what he's doing. So in one particular passage, Peter, one of the apostles, seems to see something that confirms something that he'd been told earlier by his teacher, and he says as follows: "As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to Yeshu, 'Rabbi,'" and the Greek literally says, "Rabbi, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered." Oh, the haraya, everything that you said was going to come to pass came to pass. Oh, baruch Hashem. Okay. So now, here's the question. What does the word rabbi, and here it's actually Rabbi, I've given you the Greek, it's Rabbi. What does the word Rav or Rabbi, what does it mean in this context? Does it mean does it mean like Rav Tabachim? Why or why not?
My teacher.
And so here, it doesn't have the connotation of authority in the sense of official leadership, as Mr. Comet described for the Babylonians. But like Dr. Schwartzbaum says, it really has the connotation of teacher, of teaching. Now, is he a rabbi in the sort of conventional rabbinic sense? That, in other words, is he the kind of person who got smicha? Probably not. It doesn't sound like it. In other words, it sounds like sort of a more spontaneous thing. Jesus was Peter's teacher, so Peter calls him rabbi, my teacher. Rabbi seems to have the sense of mastery is still there, but it's not official anymore. Now it's sort of generic in a sort of a student-teacher sense, yes.
The capacity to curse something and have it come about. That's a power that's more than just a general features power.
Well, true. In other words, he's a powerful person, but he hasn't been appointed by anybody to this position. It doesn't seem like that way, at least. But that's a good point. And that actually brings us to the next source. The next source is from the Tosefta. So now, by this point, the meaning Rav as sort of an official captain has, for the most part, disappeared. And instead, what we've seen so far is like, for example, in Mark, the meaning of rabbi is teacher. Now let's see how that holds up in the Tosefta. The Tosefta actually has an interesting discussion about Hashavas Aveda. If you find a lost object, you're biblically obligated to return it to its owner under certain circumstances. Now let's say you have multiple objects and each one belongs to a different person. So there must be some manner by which you can determine priority. In other words, whose object, biblically, takes priority over another person's object. Okay, or at least, in other words, which biblical mitzvah takes precedence over the other biblical obligation, even if they're of like kind. So the Tosefta says as follows: "V'ezahu rabbo." So the Tosefta had said, commenting on the Mishnah, that if you have the option to return a lost object to your rav, to your rabbi, or to your parent, to your father, you return it to your rabbi first. So what becomes imperative is to determine who was a Rav, right? Now, the Gemara, the Tosefta asks, "V'ezahu Rabbo, who was your Rav?" Now we're going to have to bear in mind what it means that we're asking Ve'ezu Rabbo. Who is your Rav? Tzavta says, Rabbo Shalimdo Torah. Lo Rabbo Shalimdo Umanus. Ve'ezeze Rabbo Shalimdo. Ve'ezeze Rabbo Shalimdo Upasach Lo Tchila. Rav Meir Omer, Rabbo... Rabbo Shalom do Chachma, lo Rabbo Shalom do Mikra. Rav Yehuda Omer, kol Sherov Talmudim Imenu. Rav Yossi Omer, kol Sheheir Einav Mishnasa. Okay. So the Sefta says, who is his Rav? In other words, the one to whom he has to return an object first. His Rav, who taught him Torah, not his Rav, who taught him craftsmanship. And who is this Rav? Eza Zer Rabbo. The one who taught him and opened him up at the outset, I guess that means really he taught him at an early stage, taught him Aleph Beis, maybe something like that. That's his Rav. Anyone who taught him Torah even from an earliest stage. Rav Meir says, no, it's his Rav who taught him Chachma, and not just his Rav who taught him Scripture. Chachma in this context here and in the Yerushalmi, Chachma here doesn't mean Gentile or secular wisdom, as it sometimes means, it actually means oral Torah or wisdom wisdom in the sense of rabbinic wisdom, not in the sense of just sort of science and math. So that's what Rabbi Meir says. His Rav who taught him Torah Shebal Peh, or some whatever the equivalent is in the Tosefta, and Rabbi Yehuda says anyone from whom the majority of his knowledge comes. Presumably, this means his Torah knowledge, Talmudo. And Rav Yossi says, anyone who enlightened his eyes b'mishnasa, with oral teaching. In other words, anyone who really taught him how to engage in the type of learning that is required for oral Torah, for the enterprise of oral Torah. Okay. Now, taking sort of a step back from this text, so what several things can we glean from this text? So first of all, the Tosefta asks the question, who is his Rav? You have to return your object to your Rav before you return it even to your father, let's say. And the Tosefta asks, well, who was his Rav? So by asking that, what does the Tosefta imply?
Some sort of formal scholarship that people learned.
Right. There, in other words, there are people who are rabbis, and it's some sort of right authoritative position. But when the Tosefta says, who is his Rav? So, the first answer that Tosefta gives is not, in other words, you would have expected if Rav meant rabbi only, like in other words, rabbi in the sense of ordained, then we could have skipped right to the question of Ve'ezeze Rabbo, Shalimdo Pasach Lo Tchila. In other words, the Tosefta gives a laundry list of different gradations of rabbinic learning, but prior to that, it specifies that his Rav is his rabbi who taught him Torah, not his rabbi who taught him craftsmanship. So what does that imply?
That a Rav can be anybody who teaches you anything.
Right, a Rav can be... excellent. So I actually want to hit on a nuance in that. A Rav can be anybody who teaches you anything. Now...
Even a trade. Even the shop teacher. Well, they're all teachers. The shop teacher.
Right, correct. Now, so this is going to bring us, I think, to one side. We're going to have to bring ourselves back to the other side of the debate. But, in other words, what we can, I think, demonstrate from this is, as Dr. Schwarzbaum says, Rav actually has a more abstract implication than just rabbi, capital R. Rav can mean someone who teaches you anything, even craftsmanship. So, in other words, just because we find a rabbi, let's say in the archaeological record, we needn't necessarily assume, that it is a rabbi, spiritual leader rabbi. Maybe it's a craftsmanship rabbi, maybe. Now, on the other hand, as Dr. Schwarzbaum rightly pointed out, Rav doesn't just mean someone who is mechubad, somebody who's a gavra. Rav does seem to require some sort of instruction. You can't be a rav just because you're a good guy. What makes you a rav is that you're a teacher. Which is precisely the sense that we saw in Mark. Right? That's why Jesus is a rabbi. You become a rabbi by being a teacher. Now, bearing in mind the inscription that we saw in the beginning of class, so it's difficult, I think, to assume, well, it's difficult to assume that a person would be called a Rav just because they gave a lot of money. That doesn't seem to be among the options that we've surveyed so far. But they might be, a Rav might be, a teacher. Maybe Rav Tanchum HaLevi was Rav Tanchum HaLevi because he taught somebody something, not necessarily Torah. A possibility.
Why are you so shocked by that?
No, I'm not, but it's a good point.
How many honorary doctorates, the universities, the right. And how does the person get it? Come on.
Right, okay. Just by being right.
That might be a change.
True. But let me ask you a question. In other words,
from the time of Yirmiyahu to this one, you're talking about 900 years.
True.
It's an enormous amount of time, so you could have an evolution in the meaning.
Precisely.
Of a word.
Precisely, and I think that Mr. Kahn is exactly correct. The term seems to have evolved significantly. But in the time frame that we're talking about, so Rav seems to have the possibility to mean Rabbi, capital R, spiritual leader, or a teacher. Now, here's the fly in the ointment. Everything we've done so far, I think, is very sound. However, there is another thing that we know about rabbis, capital R, and how they use the term rabbi. And it should make us a little bit more suspicious of how we've read the Tosefta up until now. Take a look at the source in source number 3. The source number 3 is from the Yerushalmi, and this story has parallels in other places as well. And the story tells us the following. Rebbe being Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, or Yehuda the Prince, whom we're going to discuss next week. Rebbe hava mamane trei minyan. In havun kedai hayim miskaimin. Ve'ilo havun mistalkin. Midamach pakid. V'amar levrei, amar le, lo sa'abid kein, elamani kulun kechada, umani lerv chanina barchama, bereisha, or barosha. V'lama lo manisehu, amar abi jose, begin to tzavachan ilave or aloi tziporoi. Begin tzavacha avdin, amar blazabere de rabbi yosi, or rather barabi yosi, ashe shivu tam barabim, ma tam shivu. Rabbi Hayy Yosef Masni Apaltapletayam Vahayu El Heharim Kiyone Hage Ayos Kulam Homios Amarle Homos Amarle Hain Karisa Amarle Kdamar Famnuna de Bavel Amarle Katechas the Taman Amarle the Hamanisa Chakim Vidal de Lamasmani Biomai. Okay, the story is as follows. Rabbi Huda Hanasi, who had some sort of leadership position, we're going to have to define what it is next time. Rebbe would make 2 appointments every year. What sort of appointments would he make? Seems like he would make some sort of rabbinic appointment. Minoy seems to be the equivalent in Babylonian sources of smicha. Sounds like, in other words, he would give 2 people smicha every year. Great. That's a good quota. Now, if the person was worthy to receive his smicha, then that person would remain. Now, it's important to recall that some of the Achronim interpreted this minoy as being appointed to an official communal position. The best of the evidence that we have is that that's not the case, both in terms of how minoy is used throughout the Yerushalmi and also how the Bavli translates this word. It seems to be the equivalent of smicha. Okay, so person was sort of appointed as a rabbi. Now, if the person was worthy, they would stay a rabbi, and if not, they would be removed. Now, when Rebbe was dying, he said to his son, don't do what I did. In other words, don't have this system of 2 appointments and have them be sort of in limbo. Instead, appoint all the people who are worthy to be appointed, appoint them all at the same time, and make Rav Chanina Bar Chama, who was one of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's star pupils, right? Make him at the head, which seems to have the implication here of first. In other words, of all the people who need to be appointed, make him number 1. So in other words, first appoint him, then appoint all the other guys. And why did he, now the Yerushalmi asks, why didn't, in other words, it's clear from that story, it doesn't mean that Rav Chanina Bar Chama had to be put at the head of the group, it just meant that he hadn't been appointed yet, he hadn't been ordained yet. Why didn't Rabbi Huda ordain him himself? So Rav Jose said, because the people of Tzipori, of Sepphoris, which the a shul from which we looked at last time, they protested about him. Ah, but just because people scream that they don't like the rabbis, so we give in to them? The answer is yes. But ideally, the answer is no. So instead, the Yerushalmi quotes Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, who said the following. He said, and this is the important part, he said, Rav Chanina, this is the part that we're going to focus on. He says, Rav Chanina bar Chama wasn't appointed at first because he refuted an explanation of his teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, in public. And what explanation did he refute? Rabbi was sitting and teaching, and he cited the pasuk, but they that shall escape from Yechezkel, they that shall escape shall be in the mountains like doves of the valley. All of them are moaning. And he pronounced the word in that pasuk, homiyos. And Rav Chanina bar Chama said to him that the pasuk should actually be read not homiyos, but homos, which is how we have it in our Tanakh. So Rabbi replied to him, he said, where did you hear that the word has to be read homos as opposed to homiyos? And he said, I heard this from Rav Hamnuna in Babylonia. I traveled there, I learned from him, and I heard that the pasuk should be pronounced that way. So Rabbi said to him, when you descend there, tell him that I have appointed you Chakim. And Rav Chanina knew when he heard that, Rav Chanina knew that he would not be appointed he would not be appointed in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's lifetime. Now, what does this story tell us about the term rabbi? So in order to become a rabbi, you had to be appointed by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And Rav Chanina bar Chama apparently did something to offend Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So what does Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi do? How does he punish him? He doesn't appoint him, but he does do something for him. In other words, he wasn't a shmo. He calls him a chakim.
What
is chakim? So it comes from the word chacham, right? So chakim would be sort of a wise person, right? Like for instance, in Aramaic, da'il chakim abiramiz, a wise person, right? What?
Or a
wise man. Right, maybe. Maybe a smarty pants, right? Maybe that's what's going on here. He said, you're a smart guy, right? Because you were able to correct me on a technical point, but you're missing some essential quality that makes you unworthy of the post that I could possibly appoint you to. Now, Rebbe eventually corrects his first impression, has his son appoint him, but the point is that apparently, even if you were worthy, like Rav Chanina bar Chama, really the best of Rebbe's students, to become a rabbi, but you were missing some ingredient, you couldn't claim the title rabbi. Instead, you got something else, chakim, or some other title that we could find. The parallel source has zakein. Right? You can get to be the parallel source in the Babylonian Talmud. You can be a zakein, you can be a chakim, but you can't be a rabbi. What does this story tell us about how the sages of the Jerusalem Talmud, at least, of the Yerushalmi, conceived of the title rabbi?
They were sensitive, yes.
Excellent. They were very sensitive to how it was used.
Right.
Right. Which is familiar. In other words, we're very familiar with this. Right. They were very careful about how this term should be used. Not anybody could be a rabbi. You had to be qualified. Right, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had to, right, exactly,
yeah,
right.
He has muster with the right person.
Right, correct, all of these things.
It hasn't changed.
But, right, perhaps, right, so.
Was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi the only one giving out smicha?
Ah, good question, right, so what did you have to do, in other words, were there other people who could have appointed Rav Chanina bar Chama in his place?
Was this only in Tzipori, or was this
right.
Else? I mean,
excellent, so that's actually a really good question. It's a really good question.
He went to Rabbi Chanina, and he can't go there and seek an appointment higher than.
Right. In other words, it sounds like the big game in town is in Tzipori. It's a great question. I would like to answer it now, but it's so relevant to what we're going to do next week that I'm gonna shelve it for now, and we're going to take it off the shelf next week because it leads in perfectly. But remind me that question was asked. Okay. Okay. So now we have the following conundrum. In other words, we have all these rabbis who appear in the archaeological record, really, dozens and dozens and dozens. We've given one example so far. We'll see another couple in just a minute. We know that the semantic range of the title rabbi shifted throughout the centuries, originally meaning sort of official leader, captain, shifting all the way to teacher. And we know that the Tosefta is at least aware that teacher can mean something other than spiritual guide, even though it's by far the most preferred term in the Tosefta. In other words, the Tosefta dispenses with that option almost immediately and really focuses on the only rabbis that mattered to it, which were the ones who teach Torah. And moreover, in the Gospels, we know that rabbi seems to have some spiritual connotation. So, but we know at least that the Tosefta is aware that rabbi can mean teacher in a broader sense. And yet, we know that the rabbis of Chazal are extremely sensitive to how that term is deployed. So, if it were true that the rabbis that we encounter in the archaeological record are in fact none of them members of Chazal, and they're all just donors or professors of something else, or they're craftsmen that are members of a professional guild, we would expect, I think, that Chazal would be up in arms about this. There are all these people running around the countryside claiming the title rabbi, ubiquitous in lots of places we're going to see in a moment that were really strongholds of rabbinic presence, at least according to rabbinic sources. We would expect the rabbis would be sensitive to this issue. We would expect they would at least mention it once. And in fact, they don't mention this at all. Which is certainly suggested, not dispositive. Finally, we're going to take a look at our last piece of evidence here in terms of answering this question, which is also, I think, the most interesting and discomforting, and that is in source number 4. Source number 4 is from Beit She'arim. Has anyone ever here ever been to Beit She'arim? Has anyone here ever been to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's Kever in the Galil?
Yeah, I think we were there.
So if you go there, you'll recognize it. It's sort of a three-door facade. There's a big facade, there's a major door in the middle, and then two doors on each side. It's in the Galil. It's sort of a whole complex of catacombs, of burial catacombs, and one of the graves there, which is unmarked, it's been suggested that it's the grave of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and that in fact the graves of his descendants and student are right nearby. It's impossible to know for sure. I think on the balance, it's probably likely that it is his tomb. So this is one of those cases where we got lucky. Now that said, the catacombs of Beit She'arim, which, as we'll see in a moment, had a major rabbinic presence, we'll have to figure out whether that's capital R or small r, also has lots of other very interesting things in it. And two of those very interesting things I've given you pictures of here. Now let's see if we can figure out what they are. Okay, in this picture over here, this sort of long rectangle. So what do we have here? I apologize for the quality of the image. It's not as good as I wanted it to be. They look like Kruvim. That actually was the first time I saw these. That's what I thought they were. In fact, however, we know they're not Kruvim for a couple of reasons. Number one, what is separating these two sort of like angelic, you know, cherubic looking figures? It looks like a flower. Excellent. So what it is, in Greek, would have been called a Stephanos. A Stephanos, which is where the name Stephen comes from, Stephan. A Stephanos means a wreath. And a wreath in Greek culture, going back many, many, many years, was an award. It was an award that you got for public speaking back when those things mattered. It was an award that you got for putting on the best play, the best tragedy, the best comedy, that you got for winning a major victory. The wreath, the Stephanos, was a symbol of victory. Now, there was a particular deity who was associated with victory in Greek culture, who eventually, over the years, fortuitously, came to be associated with Michael Jordan, and that is Nike. Excellent. So Nike was a winged deity wearing a robe, carrying a wreath. These two deities here, now if you'll see, we know they're not Kruvim also because they're wearing, if you can see where their feet are, you can see that they're wearing robes. All right, so these are wearing robes, they're winged, they're carrying between the two of them a Stephanos, a wreath. So these are Nikes. These are depictions of Nikes. Now, so in this big burial complex, which is a Jewish burial complex, so on someone's grave you have two Greek gods, or a depiction of a Greek deity. Interesting. Interesting to say the least. Now, it's going to be even more interesting when we find out which catacomb this tomb was located in, but we'll save that for a moment. Now, to the right of that is
Leda.
Excellent, really good. Right, so to the right of that is a depiction. So let's figure out what's in this image to the right of this. So Mrs. Falk identified it as Leda. So why do you say that?
Because
there's a swan. As you'll see, there's a big bird there. the picture is blurry, and I'm glad that it is because we're in a shul. But the swan is having intimate relations with the woman on the right, and this is right, and this is the depending on whether the myth, how the myth is to be understood, it's either non-consensual or perhaps consensual. This is depicting the myth of Leda and the swan. This union produces, at least according to the myth, several famous people, perhaps the most famous of which, because we learn about her in middle school, is Helen of Troy, or who eventually becomes Helen of Troy. Now, this is also in the Beit Sha'arim catacombs, a couple of feet away, or a couple of yards away from where Yehuda Nasi is buried. This scene in the Beit Sha'arim catacombs.
It's a weird place.
Yeah. It's a weird place. So on the one hand, this is a burial tomb that has lots of this imagery on it. And on the other hand, here's a representative inscription just below the Nike scene that reads as follows: Kan hein manchot atio bitol shorbi gamliel ben Nechemia shemesa basula bas eser nishtayim shana v'atio Bitel shel Rabbi Yehuda beno shel Rabbi Gamliel shemesa bas teisha shanim v'shisha chodashim amidasan, the rest of that which got cut off probably to heyim at tzadikim, as follows. The inscription says, here they lie, Atio, the daughter of Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Nechemia, who died a virgin at the age of 22 years, and Atio, the daughter of Rabbi Gamliel, who died at the age of 9 years and 6 months, may their resurrection be with the worthy. Okay, now, this inscription comes from Catacomb 20, the very same catacomb as this Nike tomb. Now, it happens to be that in Catacomb 20, Catacomb 20 is very important, because Catacomb 20 in Beit Sha'arim is basically all rabbis, or family members of rabbis. In terms of where the rabbis are to be found in Beit Sha'arim, and there are many of them, many of them seem to be grouped together. And in particular, in Catacomb 20, they're grouped together. What's interesting about the rabbis in Catacomb 20, and really the rabbis throughout Beit Sha'arim, with a couple of exceptions, one of them, supposedly the child of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, but we'll get into that a little bit more next time. The rabbis are distinguished in Beit Sha'arim because their tombs, unlike the other tombs, have no Greek epigrams on them, which is to say they have no Greek writing on them, no Greek inscriptions on them. The rabbi tombs are all in Hebrew. The rabbi tombs, by and large, don't feature pagan imagery, even though some of their children have at least suggestive imagery, if not outright pagan imagery. But the rabbis' tombs are grouped together, and they have no Greek on them. And also very little pagan imagery. That would suggest to me that the people that we're dealing with here are not simply sirs or madams, but they are rabbis with a capital R. Now, rabbis with a capital R can either mean spiritual leaders or it can mean craftsmen. I tend to think that the evidence from here would indicate spiritual leaders, because of the lack of Greek, because they're all grouped together, because the relative lack of pagan imagery. But note that in that catacomb, not on a tomb that's labeled as a rabbi, but in the same place where all these rabbis are buried, you have Nike. Worth considering. And a couple of feet away, and a couple of catacombs away, you have Leda and the swan.
Have okay. Because you said the catacombs are between the 2nd and the 4th century.
Right.
So is it possible that that might have been done at a time differently than at the time of burial?
Yeah, it is. It is certainly possible. It's certainly possible that they were done at different times. Some of the catacombs, though, that have rabbis in them, we can date more securely, like specifically to the 4th century, even though, again, that's a very long period of time. But in other words, Mr. Comet's point, I think, is well taken, which is that we needn't assume that all of these were made together. But the fact that they're found together, even if it's a long time apart, also suggests it. Now, I want to get a little bit more specific in terms of who these rabbis were, because there's another title, and this gets back to Dr. Schwarzbaum's point. There's another title that appears to describe a rabbi, and it's a title that's a little bit more specific than just Rav or Rabbi, both of which we've seen outside of rabbinic context, in Ugaritic context or in the Gospels, and that is the following. Take a look at the next inscription. This is on the grave of someone named Yitzchak ben Yosef Biribi. Biribi is a title that is found, other than in these archaeological sources, nowhere else in ancient Near Eastern literature, but in Chazal. And I've given you a source here, and we're going to have to figure out what the term Biribi here means. And with that, we'll have to finish up. Ma'aseh Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosi, Shehayu Mesubin Ba'ako, V'kiddush Alayin Hayom. Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Yosi, Biribi, Ritzoneich, Nafsik, L'Shabbos. Amar Lo, B'chol Yom Atam Mechabev, Devarai, B'fnei Yehuda, V'achshav Atam Mechabev, Divrei Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda, B'fonai. Hagam, Lichbosh, Zamalka, Yemi Ba'bayis. Amar Lo, M'kein, Lo Nafsik, Shematikva, Halach L'doros. Amru, Lo Zaz Misham, Achakova, Halach, Rabbi Yosi. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yosi were all eating together in Akov, and it came time for the Shabbos. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said to Rabbi Yosi, now note that Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Yehuda had maintained a halakhic argument about whether or not you need to stop a meal that goes into Shabbos when it comes time to be Shabbos. So Rabbi Yosi was of the opinion that you don't need to stop your meal. Rabbi Yehuda thinks that you do need to be mafsik. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said to his two apparently senior colleagues, and bear that in mind for next time also, but Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says to his two apparently senior colleagues, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yosi, basically, what do I do? So he turns to Rabbi Yosi, and he says to him, Biribi, is it your will that we should pause for Shabbos, in deference to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? And Rabbi Yosi says, you always listen to me over Rabbi Yehuda, because I'm always right, and now you're telling me, when Rabbi Huda's in front of me, you're going to tell me we should follow Rabbi Huda's opinion? Hagam lich was zamalka mi babayis? Are you going to ravish the queen even as I'm in the house? So Rabbi Gamliel said, you know what? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, you know what? You're right. We're not going to follow Rabbi Huda's opinion. We're going to find we're going to follow your opinion. And in fact, they didn't leave there until they made sure everybody knew that the halacha followed Rabbi Yosi. Now, the term here that's important is Biribi. What does Biribi symbolize in this context and why? So who is, of these three characters, who appears to be the senior one? Rabbi Yosi. He's the one whose opinion the halacha accords with. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel asks about what to do in a context like this. Who does he ask? All three of the people who are important, who are implicated in this dispute, are in the room. Who does he ask? He asked Rabbi Yosi about whether or not to follow Rabbi Huda's opinion. He asked Rabbi Yosi's permission to follow Rabbi Huda's opinion. So when he calls Rabbi Yosi Biribi, Biribi, as a term that, again, only instantiates in rabbinic literature, seems to be
my primary rabbi,
someone of great learning. So Biribi seems to be a title that indicates someone who is not just a rabbi, but a very learned person. So the fact that we find Biribi in the archaeological record would seem to indicate that this person is more than just a donor, more than just a teacher of craftsmen. He is someone of rabbinic learning. The last source is also very interesting. We don't have time for it now. But just to conclude now with to summarize where we are and figure out what this all means. We've seen the term rabbi appear in inscriptions. We've noted that it's difficult to identify most of the people, almost all of them, who appear in the inscriptions with anyone that we can find in rabbinic literature, even tentatively. We also know that the term rabbi didn't always necessarily mean someone who was a rabbi, capital R, spiritual leader. It could mean someone who was an official leader. It could mean someone who's a teacher in general, someone who's a teacher of crafts. But we also noted that the way in which these rabbis appear in the archaeological record is suggestive of the notion, because they all appear together, they appear without Greek epigrams, the title Biribi appears, which seems to indicate something rabbinic, perhaps also the fact that Rav Tanchum is honored above some of the others who gave more than him, simply because he's a Rav. All of this seems to indicate that the term rabbi, when it appears in the archaeological record, should be understood as somebody who either was a rabbi himself or somehow associated with the rabbis that we know from Chazal. Now, why is this important?
They also lack a sense of humility.
Well, in other words, right. In other words,
everybody's really fussy about titles here.
Right. In other words, right. Titles do seem to be important. We're actually going to discuss that a little bit next time. Right. Titles do seem to be important. We also noted, however, that the way in which these rabbis appear in the archaeological record is in places that they also don't seem to control. In other words, they seem to be in places where Nike is appearing, where Lita and the Swan is appearing, where things that I don't think would be considered to be appropriate in a rabbinic cemetery nowadays are certainly appearing all over the place. So they don't seem to be appearing in place, and moreover, of the people listed on the in the Max Stern Shul floor, he's not number one. He's number seven. Okay. So on the one hand, I think we certainly have rabbinic influence or presence in our sources, but we don't have rabbinic control. Now this is important, especially as a prelude to next week when we talk about rabbinic leadership in this period, because I think we as a community nowadays have a tendency, and I think it's a tendency that comes from a place of positive spiritual orientation that romanticizes the rabbinic past in such a way that the argument that's produced is as follows. Once upon a time, rabbis had control over their society. They could shape it and mold it to their desires to reflect the ideals that they held dear. And now we have to bemoan the fact that we've lost this control. Rabbis have lost control of Jewish society, and now we have to come up with plans and plots to figure out how to recover that control and ostracize those who don't conform to that control. Now, without disputing that there are, I think, appropriate sentiments that underlie that argument, I think it's worth noting that as a matter of history, other than for moments in the medieval period and the early modern period, of which I'm not an expert, but certainly in the earliest periods, in the generative periods of rabbinic history, this is certainly not descriptive in a faithful sense of what went on. The rabbis weren't in control of this society. As we've seen again and again and again in the last several classes, rabbis weren't in control of early Jewish society. However, it doesn't mean that they were absent from Jewish society. They were present in an important way, and they were confidently and proudly asserting their identity, their authority, and their ideals. I think this is a healthy balance in terms of how we should imagine our society and where it's going to go in the next couple of years. I think instead of bemoaning the control, mostly fictitious, that we believe that we've lost, I think it's important for those of us who want to remain faithful to the rabbinic model and see ourselves as really the inheritors of the Masorah of Chazal, I think it's worthwhile for us to acknowledge that, in fact, our society is very similar to the one that the earliest rabbis faced, and we face many of their same challenges. Instead of pining after control that Chazal actually never had, we should instead understand that Chazal faced our challenges, and they faced it with creativity, with joie de vivre, with a sense of entrepreneurship in terms of meeting the challenges of the next generation with, on the one hand, fealty to the Masorah, with fealty to the traditions that came before us, but on the other hand, with understanding that we live in a society like Beit Sha'arim. We live in a society where there are rabbis and places of appropriate sacred space, but there are also people who want to put their Lita and the Swan in our burial places. And that's just, instead of moaning about that fact, that's the society that we live in. And we should, instead of trying to demolish it and recreate it in our own image, we should instead shape it and seek, I think, in a healthy and a positive and in a confident and also serious and rigorous manner, attempt to inject our ideals into that society and have them shape it and mold it rather than trying to knock it down and replace it with something wholly new. With that, I wish you a very good evening. Technical question.
Go back, Rav, the one on Yerushalmi, where he makes two appointments. And then he said you should appoint Rabbi Hanina. If he hadn't appointed him yet, why is he called a rabbi?
Ah, right, that's a good point. I think the assumption is because the Yerushalmi, right, so in other words, why does the Yerushalmi refer to him?
What the outcome was?
I think that's the answer, right? They were anticipating the conclusion. Yashakoach.